Okay, so welcome everyone to today's conversation on engaged learning in higher education in times of massive developments in online distance and hybrid education. My name is Lovisa Håkansson and I work at the Unit for Academic Teaching and Learning at Uppsala University with an area that we call active student participation. Active student participation, as we define it, is about how students can support, empower, and challenge each other's learning, as well as students as co-creators in planning, implementation, and evaluation of higher education. But who are students supposed to co-create with? Active student participation, as we see it, also naturally involves teachers, given that it's teachers and students that are the essential participants and creators of teaching and learning at universities. So the format for this conversation today, a podcast, was chosen as a way of trying to create learning content that in times where education, no matter if it's done online or at campus, usually involves a lot of screen and visual learning, like we're watching screen, we're reading on screen, we're writing on screen, we're looking at the whiteboard when we're at campus. And we hope that this type of format can invite to another type of learning where listening is at the center. Podcasts can be used as conversation starters in class with students or when you have a meeting with your colleagues. When learning is visual as sedentary, scheduling time for students to listen to pods or so-called pod walks, where students take a walk in their surrounding and then come back to do a synchronous online discussion with their class, can add nice variety to students' learning. And to the topic of today then, for many years now, we have witnessed an increase in engaged learning activities in higher education. Teachers and students team up and create partnerships where they work together to make education better. The COVID-19 pandemic have led to new challenges and opportunities for student engagement and student-faculty partnership in higher education. Therefore, the topic we will zoom in on today is engaged learning in times of developments in online, distance, and hybrid education. I have invited four people who have extensively researched, written, and practiced engaged learning in higher education for many years. A warm welcome to Alison Cookstater, Catherine Beauville, Cherry Woolmer, and Peter Felton, who I'm so happy are here with us today from across time zones. Okay, guys, so I think we will start off with a group introduction. So first, Cherry, where do you work and in what role do you work?
Hi, Louisa and colleagues. I'm Cherry Woolmer. I work at a small undergraduate institution in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, called Mount Royal University. I'm an assistant professor there and also in a slightly new role for the institution, which is called a Canada Research Chair with a focus on scholarship of teaching and learning. And I've been there for just over a year.
Okay, super. And then I have this kind of a social or ice-breaking question. Do you have any fond memory from the summer that you would like to share with the group and the listeners?
I have very fond memories of slowing down a little, but in particular, I'm a big fan of being on the water whenever I can. And I made some time to make sure that I got out canoeing and kayaking and paddleboarding with my family this summer. And it was just delightful, which is great because it's about to get down to minus 40 C in the Albertan winter pretty quickly. So I made the most of it while it was available to me.
Sounds nice. Thanks a lot. Peter, where do you work and in what role?
Hi, everyone. I'm Peter Felton. I'm at UMON University in North Carolina. We've got about 7,000 students, mostly undergraduates. mostly teaching focused. I have too many roles. So main thing, I'm a professor of history and education, and I work with something called the Center for Engaged Learning, which is a research center that studies undergraduate education.
Okay, and do you'd like to share any memory from the summer?
Well, apparently Cherie and I have something in common. Although I wasn't on the water, I was adjacent to the water. But one of my fondest memories from the summer is my son and I went for a very long hike in the mountains of Western North Carolina and got to soak our feet in the pools below several waterfalls. And for many hours, we were in this beautiful space and we didn't see any other humans. And it felt like the world was like the last 2 years hadn't happened. And it was lovely.
Sounds really, really, really lovely. Okay. And Kathy, where do you work?
So, hi, I'm Kathy Bovell. I'm a senior lecturer in student engagement based at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And the University of Edinburgh is, in contrast to Elon University, enormous. So we have 45,000 students. And I think if you add in the staff that work at the institution, we're about the size of a small city. So yeah, pretty big institution. And it's exciting because we cover loads of different subject areas. It's a real sort of wide university, and that makes for really interesting work. So I predominantly work as an academic developer, working with staff members to try to support them to do better teaching, and to try to support them to be inspired to think how they can engage their students in a more meaningful way. So I have all sorts of things that I work on, but that's the main area of my work.
Thanks. And a summer memory.
I think one of my fondest summer memories, I'm sure I share with many people, the joy of being able to see family again. Depending on where you were in the world, we certainly in the UK were facing lockdown for quite long periods of time. And so connecting with family again was really important. And my brother and sister-in-law and family decided that because we had missed Christmas, we weren't allowed to get together at Christmas, we would celebrate Christmas in June. So we literally had the stockings out and all the traditions, a big dinner, and everything that normally happens at Christmas took place in June. And we had a great deal of fun celebrating Christmas in June, with a suggestion from the children that it should happen in June as well as December every year.
That's so funny. It's nice that you found ways to still celebrate Christmas, right? Super. Thanks a lot, Kathy. And Alison, where do you work? And tell us something from your summer.
So I'm Alison Cook-Sather. I work at Bryn Mawr and Haverford Colleges, which are two small liberal arts colleges in the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States. And I've been there for about 27 years, so a long time. And my role is half-time in our education program, where I teach undergraduate courses in education, and half-time in our Teaching and Learning Institute, which is designed to support faculty reflection on teaching, primarily in partnership with undergraduate students. So I've run our Students as Learners and Teachers program there since 2006. And that's really in both my education teaching and my partnership facilitation. I focus on partnership in that way, and thinking about how our classrooms can be not only engaging, but also more equitable and inclusive. So that's really my main area of focus. And this summer, I was focused more on being a parent, because my daughter is getting ready to go off to college and is starting with the semester of study abroad in Costa Rica, which is going to be highly experiential and highly engaging, we hope. And then, you know, she's heading off on her own, you know, to make her way and engage in her own ways in higher education. And it's really exciting to see the way she's thinking about it and planning and packing and just anticipating, you know, what it's going to mean for her. So she's going to now enter the arena where I work, in a very different context, of course, but it's really interesting to see her evolving into that sort of state and of anticipation, and also of engagement already, you know, with the process of what learning is going to look like for her.
Okay, thank you all so much for introducing yourselves and being so nice sharing something from your summers. That's really nice of you. Okay, so just to kick off the conversation around the topic of today, I was thinking that it could be good if we try to put into words how we understand engaged learning. There are many terms for this topic, but if you would start, Catherine, how do you understand or define engaged learning? What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, it's a good question and a tricky one to start with. But for me, I think it's there's a true focus here on connection and relationships. To me, those are key elements of learning that enable somebody to become engaged. So for me, connection and relationships would be absolutely key, but also there's something there. We've often talked about the different kinds of relationships. So it's relationships between students and teachers. It's relationships between students and students. It's also relationships between students and the subject matter that they're learning. So there are many of those connections and relationships are important in engaged learning. And I think it's also learning where students are working with teachers rather than learning being something done to a student or done to groups of students. So this is changing essentially the way that sometimes many colleagues think about learning and teaching. It's changing it through students gaining confidence that they have a role within their own learning. And that often happens by opening up dialogue between students and teachers to talk about what matters to them, what matters to them in relation to what they're learning. And I think that confidence that grows can then enable students to gain a sense of agency over their learning. So those are some of the key elements for me. And probably a last point I would make is that I also think in engaged learning that we hear students talking more than in a classroom where it's not so engaged. So students' voices become far more important in learning and teaching where we're talking about engaged learning. So that would be my starting point, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Catherine. Looks, I saw some nodding here taking place, but is there anyone who'd like to add anything or who wants to add anything to what Catherine said? Was she missing something, maybe? Alison?
I don't think she was missing anything, but as she was talking, I was thinking about the words that she was using: connection, relationship, confidence, agency. And I was thinking about how, for me, engaged learning is also when students carry all of those things beyond the immediate learning experience, right? So they're engaged in the immediate learning experience, but then they also have the confidence and the connection and can form relationships and have the sense of agency to carry that kind of engagement into other contexts that might not be as conducive to engagement or as supportive of that kind of active engagement. But the students themselves have developed the capacity to make more opportunities for engaged learning beyond, you know, the immediate context for the learning. So something about carrying that capacity forward and into other contexts, I think, is an important aspect of engaged learning that endures.
That is so interesting. And do you think then that same, you know, carrying on or developing characteristics or competences wouldn't happen as much if learning is more, you know, disengaged or passive or, yeah, okay, yeah.
They're nodding here. Everybody's nodding. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so there's something more than just learning the subject matter and the content here. Okay, interesting. Kathy, go on.
Yes, I think what we're talking about to some degree, I think, is inspiring students so that they feel more passionate about the subject they're learning or more passionate about their own learning experiences, that they want to get engaged in more than just that one classroom or that one course, just as Alison has mentioned. And many students, I think, also then want to get more involved with the university as a whole. And so this is when we start seeing students actually take part in many more extracurricular activities, or these are often students who've been engaged in a classroom, but they then start to be interested in accepting opportunities to take on more responsibility for projects or other ways that they can contribute to the university as a whole. So I really like Alison's extension that this goes sort of beyond that first engagement.
Interesting, thank you. I'm thinking about, because a lot of the keywords that you were talking about in the beginning, Kathy, like connection, relationships, etc. These are not maybe words that would usually be words that people in academia use in the academic setting, basically, because the academic setting is quite, at least traditionally, and things are happening, but traditionally the academic setting is more about, you know, the rational mind maybe, and also science and the science mind, and thinking about relationships. Why is that important? So is there anything we can say about that? How does these two, you know, components of academia go together? Peter is raising his hand. Go on.
Yeah, great question. I don't think that the traditional separations you're describing are real. I mean, I think they're habits and practices that we have, but I don't think they need to exist. So as we're talking about engaged learning, I agree with everything Kathy and Alison have said, that it's purposeful and meaning-making and all this. That doesn't mean it's not about learning chemistry really well, right? But it tends to have this sense of purpose to it, that the student's curiosity, the student's interest, the student's meaning-making is driving it, rather than I'm performing in this way because the professor is going to test me. And if I don't pass the test, I can't take chemistry too. You know, that's not the driving motivation here. And the second thing is, I think, at least in the US in higher education, we forget that students are humans and humans are relational. And so the research is really quite clear that, as Kathy was talking about, things like student-student interactions in a classroom can be really motivating, can help students build confidence, can help students deepen their learning in ways. So it's not that those kinds of relational moves are in opposition to learning science or learning academic content or academic skills. They're actually complementary to it. But I think too often in the US, we think if the professor's talking, then it's rigorous. And if the students are talking, it's not. And I would say the exact opposite is true. What we really need in engaged learning is students to be able to do the learning. And so they need to be working, they need to be thinking, they need to be trying to make these connections, whether it's about how this history course that I teach connects to my family's history, or how this chemistry course helps me understand how the molecules work. Either of those are good things to be engaged about.
Thanks, Peter. What an interesting elaboration on that question. So, Sherry, what do you like to add?
Just to complement really what everybody has shared already, and to build on that final point that Peter was just making about students being engaged in relationships and the benefit of that. Similarly, faculty and staff in teaching roles. We are human. We our day-to-day business in academia is also relational. And I think the affective components, the emotional components, are as equally important for faculty to be engaging teachers as it is for students to be engaged learners, you know, going back to Kathy's point about connection there. And so there's an element of, it's not a concise definition, I suppose, but for me there's that important affective dimension for all members of our community when we're thinking about what an engaged higher education community looks like, and we're all engaged, perhaps differently. I think the distinction you were describing earlier there, Louisa, often for me, I agree with Peter's point about that being somewhat of an artificial distinction, but if you scratch beneath the surface, I think really what you're getting at are things like hierarchy and power, actually, that create distance rather than concepts of the science of learning. So again, power and hierarchy kind of connect also to these affective relational connection points there too. So, which has been written about extensively in the existing literature, and I'm sure we'll come back to that point. So yeah, lots of descriptive words I think we've all shared without a single definition, but I think that speaks to the complexity of this realm of work and the scholarship and the research on this area too.
Thanks, Sherry. So I think we could maybe move on a bit then to or maybe both take a step back looking at like the developments research-wise and practice-wise of engaged learning the last years, the last 5 years to 10 years, and also maybe discuss a bit like maybe you've already mentioned it, but what are like burning issues in engaged learning today, you would say? Would you like to start a bit, Cherry, on that question?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the most obvious things to share or an observation is just the volume of research and practice has increased exponentially in this topic, and showing a kind of increase in interest across a really wide range of disciplinary contexts. So, you know, I don't think the idea of active student participation or student faculty partnerships is niche anymore. I think it has entered a different realm in terms of the number of people engaged in the research and practice. And I think another really exciting component is with that increase in interest, we're seeing a diversity of national contexts where this is happening, and different educational systems underpinned by different kind of educational approaches, values, philosophies around the world. And to think that we are seeing that within a relatively short space of time, so, you know, seeing colleagues in countries in the East, in the Global South, engaging with these ideas alongside those of us in the Global North. I think that's really exciting, and I think that speaks to the interest and power of this idea that we're seeing this diversity in national contexts. And that's really helping us engage with some of the complexities that we were starting to talk about in the definitions of this kind of work. And I really value the problematizing and those critical reflections that come from thinking about what this means in different national as well as disciplinary contexts. I think there are a number of burning issues, exciting issues to be exploring. I mean, two that I'd throw into the mix and then let others add to. I think issues of equity, access, diversity and inclusion increasingly are at the heart of a lot of the research on this. Who is invited into these spaces, particularly if it's not involving whole cohorts of students, which voices are missing. There are scholars such as Alison who have been exploring this for some time, but I think there's an increasing range of voices coming into that critique around equity and diversity and access. Certainly from a student perspective, and I'm delighted to see student scholars adding to that discussion. Some work that I've been involved in myself with colleagues at McMaster has been looking at research on the faculty experience. So for faculty who are from marginalized communities in the academy, what are their experiences in accessing partnership spaces or engaging students in these ways? So equity and diversity, definitely one point. And another area that I'm really interested in is we speak about, as this practice increases, it creating an ethos of partnership or engaged learning in the academy, and that it might help challenge existing hierarchies. I'm really interested in seeing how we might explore that empirically. Like, what is the evidence? I think those of us that are really committed to this see the transformative potential, the radical potential to change the academy. But as this grows, I'm really interested to see how the evidence sustains our hopes and aspirations of real sustainable change in the academy. But yeah, there are many, many more, but I'll pause there and let others jump in.
Thank you, Sherry. Equity and diversity. Yeah, of course. That's really coming into this, because I think in many student experiences that I've encountered are sometimes about how students feel that it's, you know, a certain type of students who fit in different partnerships or different partnership roles. So for some students, it can be really, really hard, the experience, to enter those relationships, because there are real barriers and also other types of barriers, maybe. Is there anyone who'd like to add something to the burning issues question before we move on to, you know, this online distance and hybrid in relation to engaged learning? Alison.
Just building on what Cherie was saying, I think when you start to think about engagement within a frame of equity, you need to take a step back and think about what does learning look like? You know, what does engaged learning look like? What does learning mean? Because there are certainly cultural differences as well as individual differences about what engagement is. At least in the United States, we have a tendency to privilege individual learning and individual performance, but that's very exclusive of many ways of knowing and engaging and learning that are much more collective and community-based. And so we already privilege those in our understandings of what learning is and what engagement is. And if we're really going to think in terms of equity, we need to revisit those kinds of assumptions and say, what is a wider understanding of what engaged learning might look like? It perhaps isn't every student speaking up individually in a course, for instance, which is very typical in the United States for us to think that's engagement. You know, that student who talks all the time is engaged, but there are many other ways that engagement can look. And so I would just want to echo Cherie's point and say that we need to re-examine some of our assumptions about what learning and engagement even mean and look like if we're truly going to be equitable and inclusive.
Both Peter and Kathy wants to have the word. So go Peter first and then Kathy.
Okay, just briefly to extend the really good and deep thoughts from Sheree and Alison. is that at least in the US, I think part of what we have to do as we're moving into thinking about engaged learning and equity in particular, is to focus on the role of those of us who work in higher education to create these opportunities, to create the invitations, to create the spaces. Too often, I think in the US, we say, I'm open to anyone, and some students don't step forward, and that's just who they are, and too bad for them. We don't do that in the curriculum. We don't say, you know, take these courses if you'd like or not, engage in these experiences if you like. So we need to be what some scholars in the US, we need to think of ourselves as institutional agents and as actively working with students and actively seeking out voices and perspectives in this epistemologies and identities that we don't necessarily have or understand to create space for students to learn. We can't just wait for students to step forward.
Super good point, Peter. Kathy, what would you like to add?
Yeah, I was wanting to pick up on one of Alison's points about how often we think about this as individual learning. And I was very privileged to spend some time at Peter's institution. I was about to say last year, but the year before and a bit of last year at Elon University. And I had what I would say is a wonderful opportunity really to teach a course with a small group of students who were very engaged already, who were studying a master's course in higher education. And one of the active choices I decided in the course design before getting to class and then trying to engage the students with as much kind of co-design as we could do. But that one decision I made was that we would have one of the assessments be a collaborative class project. And it was that attempt to say that we don't all have to do a separate project. What would happen if we make this a class project? Who decides what it's going to be? It was super messy and it was very difficult at times, but actually the learning and the creativity amongst people in the class was phenomenal when you enable that to take place. So I think one of the things we haven't talked about is we're hinting at, but some of this work is difficult. And so, you know, trying to ensure that we're equitable in how we do this work, trying to ensure that we bring in more collaborative forms of learning. Those are not easy things to do. And whilst I wouldn't want to put anyone off trying this kind of work, I think it's worth also acknowledging it can be quite tricky. So there's a lot of learning along the way, and it doesn't always go perfectly the first time. And that's okay, I think. I just wanted to pick up on that point and what a joy it is to have the freedom to be able to do something like that if you've got that space to create something more collaborative and enable students to influence the direction that work goes and the direction that learning goes.
Challenges of engaged learning or in engaged learning and inclusivity and equity, of course. It's really challenging work. And if we move on then to the times that we're still experiencing now and have experienced for the last couple of years now because of the global pandemic, we could say that the existence of off-campus learning environments is not new, but the pandemic both pushed and encouraged universities all over the world to rethink ways of doing education. And in my experience, this has increased creativity among teachers in designing learning, and at times engaged learning have worked really well in the off-campus learning environment. For some students, off-campus learning has also been more convenient and easier, or helped them raise their voice, maybe. But scholars and teachers and students have also reported a lot of difficulties, such as isolation, passivity, pedagogical solitude, being a teacher, screen fatigue, turned off cameras, like these black screens, you know, and lack of informal meetings that you usually get on a physical campus more. So if you would like to start, Peter, how would you say that the increase in off-campus learning environments have affected engaged learning in general? Big question.
Yeah, big question. And you set it up really beautifully, because I think part of the challenge has been the variety of experiences that some teachers and some students have thrived. They've been able to be more creative. They've felt a sense of agency. They've felt a sense of control of their time and their work in ways that can be really helpful and generative. Many, many, many people have felt a sense of isolation and passivity. And it, again, back to what we've been talking about with equity, those experiences aren't evenly distributed across, let's say, social classes or identities necessarily. People who don't have access to a safe, quiet place with high-speed internet don't get to be as engaged if you have to, as people were doing in the US, you know, sit in a car outside of Starbucks to get Wi-Fi so that you could be in your class. The complexity of being engaged in that space is just fundamentally different, right? So I think we need to really recognize that. I'm gonna put my rose-colored glasses on though, and say, one of the things, even with this focus on inequities and on trauma from the past COVID times that we can attend to, is that I think COVID-informed teaching taught all of us in higher education that some of our assumptions were just fundamentally false, such as my students come into the classroom and all they do is focus on history at this time. And we're this neat little environment where, you know, it's just us and that's just not true. And teaching, looking at students through Zoom, it just reminds you over and over that students are whole humans. They have whole lives. They have whole complexity, right? And so in a way, it's really positive for those of us who teach to have to confront that and have to think about things like well-being alongside learning and not just pretend like I can focus only on learning. But the other positive in my rose-colored glasses frame is that by breaking down this sense that their classroom walls are bounded and learning just happens here, that actually breaks down some of what you were talking about earlier, Louisa, too, about, you know, I just teach history or I just teach chemistry and I have nothing to do with the rest of the world. It's like, no, our learning and what our students are doing is deeply informed by what's happening in the world. It can't be separated from it. And one of the things that I find really exciting about that is that in the US, the research on low-income students, first and family students to go to university, is that those students tend to be most motivated when they feel like their work is connected to their community. And they feel like what they're learning in higher education might make an impact in their community. They have this strong sense of wanting to give back to their family, to their community, to the world. And so by breaking down some of these artificial boundaries of, you know, we're just in the classroom and this is all academic, maybe one of the things COVID has helped us see is that in all of our teaching and all of our work with students, we can really be attentive to how our work is community-based. How our students are in communities and how those communities can be assets for what they do in our classrooms, for their learning, for their development, and for my teaching. Someone's coming into my office, so I'm going to pause now.
No worries. We'll continue the conversation. That's really interesting how one can use how the COVID pandemic then have maybe let us see more clearly how we can use the our surroundings basically in learning in different ways. So that is an effect, one could say. Okay, is anyone else willing to pick up on what Peter was talking about? Kathy, go for it.
Thanks. I think I was inspired by a colleague, Miriam Glessner, who's an oceanographer at Keele University. And she actually writes a blog called Kitchen Oceanography, inspired by the fact that she's had to downscale the kinds of work that she does with students, where they would normally go on field trips and be able to do experiments where they, you know, investigate real waves in the ocean. And she's been getting her students to get glasses of water on their desk and put food coloring in them, and put ice in them to represent sort of what happens in terms of water flow and things. And then she's got people taking pictures of puddles in their front garden. And so whilst the world has shrunk in many ways during the pandemic, I think the creativity levels of some faculty has been amazing. So I just think that's a small example of what Peter was describing, in a sense that for some people it's inspired this kind of amazing creativity. For others, I think it has been incredibly difficult.
Thanks, Kathy. Okay, so I think we'll move on to another question that I've been thinking about. So some universities will go back to campus learning now, all campus learning, or might, you know, do some kind of hybrid learning. And some people are planning for campus, but we'll see how it all works when we all come back to the university from summer holidays. But Alison, if you would say something on the future of engaged learning in the off-campus learning environment, as well as maybe the on-campus learning environment, how do you envision that future? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do have thoughts on it. It's actually something that the student partners I've been working with in my partnership program have thought about for the last year and have made recommendations regarding some of the things that we might, as Peter was suggesting, take forward. And Kathy's example, you know, of how do we reimagine what engaged learning looks like, both on campus and off campus. And I just wanted to give a couple of examples that student partners mentioned. And one is the Zoom chat, right? This is something that most of us have never used before in our teaching, unless we teach online. But it has created a space for communication and engagement that really is quite different from what goes on when everybody is sitting in a classroom and really only has spoken opportunities in most classrooms, not in all, of course. But so one of the things that I think we should think about is how can we create multiple channels or forums for engagement that go beyond participation, as I mentioned before, as just speaking, right, to a group out loud. How can we create these back channels or alternative ways of communicating and engaging? I hope that's something that we will think about in a much more creative and varied way going forward. Another example I want to give is co-created documents, co-created Google Docs or Jamboards or some of these other online forums that allow people to basically speak simultaneously, to engage simultaneously. I've used this a lot in my teaching over the last year, and it really allows for all voices to be heard or read at the same time, right? And most of these are anonymous, right? So there's a little bit less hesitancy about offering contributions, and people are inclined to attend to the contributions rather than think about who is offering them. And that can have positive and negative consequences, but there's a way in which a class community can build in a different way because of the inclusion and the valuing of so many voices. And the final thing about this is that you have a record, right, that you might not have. Otherwise, all the individual students taking their individual notes is very atomized, right? Whereas if you have a co-created document with everybody's thoughts, you can document growth over time, deepening of understanding, important revisions that have happened, through the course and this opportunity to articulate them. So those kinds of reimagining of the spaces and the modes of engagement is what I hope we will take from this time, regardless of context. And really, this goes to the third point I wanted to make, which was more co-creation, right? Like Kathy was describing that she did at Elon, and you know, co-creating the classroom environment by inviting students to articulate what it is that makes an engaging classroom environment for them and actually intentionally building that together. Co-creating a curriculum and assignments and assessment that is drawing on those funds of knowledge that students have from their communities, from their cultures, from their families, from themselves, that they can contribute rather than feeling like they have to leave that, you know, at the classroom door. And all of this is messy, as Kathy said, right? It takes a lot more time and managing of complexity and creating quite clear support structures that guide students, but also leave them space, right, to make choice and to take responsibility. So I guess the last thing I would want to say about this kind of brings us full circle to where Kathy started with connection and relationship. The main thing that the student partners in my program said that we should take forward into whether it's remote, hybrid, or in-person teaching and learning is caring about each other as people, caring for one another as people. They say, be present, be communicative, be flexible, be encouraging, start with and sustain the human. That's what they emphasize. And that's what I would say about what we need to think about in terms of actually creating engagement, the opportunities for engagement that can include and be contributed to by everyone.
Thanks a lot, Alison, for giving us some, you know, practical examples as well of how engaged learning can look like now, and also what we can bring with us to the future. So I see that you want to come into the conversation, but I'll try to keep to the time we have for now. But so we're moving into some conclusion now, because unfortunately time is running out, and we don't want our listeners to experience audio fatigue neither. So to conclude now this conversation, or to sum it up a bit, listeners of this podcast will hopefully be students, teachers, researchers, and hopefully also university leaders. So if you guys imagined having a conversation with each of these groups of people around engaged learning, what do you think you would talk about together? So Alison, first, if you had a conversation with students on engaged learning, what do you think you would talk about? What would you like to discuss with them, or tell them, or?
Well, this is actually something I do every single semester in all of my courses and through all of the partnership work that I do. We start by having that conversation. And what I often ask is, ask them to think about a time when they have felt engaged, inside or outside the classroom, and what characterized that experience. And often, more often than not, students talk about outside of the classroom, you know, when they felt engaged, and what can we do to pay attention to those qualities of experience that they articulate? How can we learn from what students articulate about their engaged experiences that we can bring into the classroom? So that's the conversation that I often have and would have again and will have again with students, really learning from them about their experiences of engagement and inviting them to articulate those for a number of reasons. One is to affirm them, right? To recognize that they have knowledge and they have insight about what it is to be engaged, that we as faculty need to learn from. I think Peter was getting at this point as well. You know, we need to be learners from our students about what it is that engages them. So that would be what I would want to talk about with students. What is it that engages you? And I would want them to listen to the differences that each of them articulates, as well as find the connections, right? And as Kathy said, this is messy, right? But I think hearing that complexity and that richness only feeds into creativity and responsiveness and empathy and understanding that not everyone's having the same experience in the classroom, even if you're doing the same thing. And so we need to be thinking about what does it mean for students to be engaged and learning from them about that.
Thank you, Alison. Peter, if you had a conversation with university leaders, what would you talk about?
Well, some of the same things. I'd want to start with some of the messiness and the complexity of doing this kind of work well, and the purposefulness and the meaning making and the inspiration and the equity that can come from doing this work well, and then point out that systems tend to get the results that they're designed to get. And our systems right now in higher education aren't often designed for messy, purposeful, community-based, equitable work. And so how can we as university leaders think critically, think carefully, think empathetically, think with students and colleagues about aligning the goals and the practices and the structures and the reward systems for everybody involved? It's in the US, one of the big challenges is around faculty. If faculty can teach in a very engaged way or in a very disengaged way, and they have the same level of promotion support, and one takes a lot of time and one doesn't take as much time, you know, it's complicated for faculty to choose to do things that are not necessarily in their professional best interest because the institution rewards one thing and not the other. But I think we also need to pay attention to students too. Many of our students come to university with very specific goals, and they're used to regular school, right? And then they come to us and they say, it's messy and it's complicated and you're gonna learn about yourself and your community. And they're like, no, I just wanna learn chemistry and get a high grade so I can get to medical school. And so we have to help them understand and create rewards and supports for them to understand why they should engage with the messy, complex meaning-making that they need to be prepared to function in the world. So I think it's a tall task in front of us as university leaders, but it's exciting to do this, and it's really meaningful to do this work.
Thank you, Peter. Sherry, if you had a conversation with researchers, what do you think you would discuss? You're researching a bit yourself, I think, too.
I guess I'd preface my comments by saying that I see certainly my research and the research in this area as being political in its nature. I'm certainly here and interested in partnership and valuing and respecting students as legitimate knowers in the academy, because I hope that research informs a meaningful change to academia and the academy. So I think I would want to be talking with researchers about what happens when we frame our research as political in its nature, with the idea that it is about creating more socially just institutions, is a personal view. And so to link that with the outcomes of our research, how do we as researchers, as a community of scholars, help influence change, whether that be in the individual classroom context, whether that be at the meso level, the middle level management discussions, or to support conversations that Peter and colleagues are engaged in at a senior level of the institution. And I think now, especially now, as a time when we've had massive disruption as a result of COVID, Josh Ehler in the States has made a call for hold the floor. We need to hold the floor and keep conversations going about the ways in which our assumptions have been pushed and challenged, and we've managed to make changes that we thought we were never possible. So I'd really want to have conversations with other researchers about what our role is in supporting that ongoing conversation at all those different levels within the academy.
Thanks. And finally, Kathy, if you would talk to teachers about engaged learning, what do you think you would talk about?
Yes, I think that's a conversation I try and have regularly to talk to teachers. And one of the things that I think I feel really passionately about in the last 2 years is actually saying that online learning is not necessarily second best. So in my university, we have about 70 online master's programs that were running before COVID hit us. And there was some amazing practice taking place. And for me, there's a really strong message that all that we've been talking about in terms of connection, relationship building, engaged learning is something that is not unique to a face-to-face in-person context. So for me, it's about a mindset that if you believe that students should have more agency in their own learning experiences, then you will try to make that happen in whatever setting you're in. And you may have preferences about certain teaching settings over another, or modes, if we want to call it that. But I still think that if you passionately believe in engaged learning, you can make that happen in any context. So that's one really key thing that I would talk to teachers about and try and hear their responses to that and hear where they're at and how they might struggle with that, or the great ideas they might have for how they're enacting that. But also I would probably be a bit provocative. And one of the papers that I've really liked in recent years, and a few of you may have heard me speak about this paper, is a paper that came from STEM disciplines, so from science, technology, engineering and maths, by Freeman and colleagues. It comes from about 2014. And in that paper, they draw together all the evidence that there is on active learning in the STEM disciplines, and essentially make a very strong argument that says if this was a medical treatment and we had the evidence that we have at the moment to support active learning, then we would stop the trial, if you like, the experiment. We would stop it because we know that the treatment is having such a beneficial impact. So we wouldn't allow you to continue with the control group, which essentially would mean that we're standing lecturing at you. And so I use this sometimes to be a bit provocative with staff to say, if we look at all the evidence on relationships and the importance of building positive relationships between staff and students, if we look at all the positive growing evidence around partnership and co-creation work, then actually, are we maybe being a bit negligent if we don't act on this and start to adapt our teaching practices? So I think those are a few sort of provocations and conversations I would like to have with teaching staff, and to hear their experiences of how teaching has changed for them over the last 18 months to 2 years.
Thanks so much, Kathy, and thanks so much to each one of you for dedicating your time to discuss these questions together with us today at the Unit for Academic Teaching and Learning at Uppsala University. And thank you all for listening to this conversation as well. And I hope you have a great rest of the day. Thank you.